There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is the Two Mats for the week ending Friday, the 8th of December. A show where we get challenged. We do get challenged, actually.
Actually, on this episode, we do.
By our very great guest, Jason Pack, at the end.
Absolutely.
He didn't like everything we said about Kissinger, but anyway.
Formidable force.
We'll come to that. What did we talk about? What should we call this episode?
Well, I think, the first thing we came to really was the total utter implosion of the British government.
Yes, so again.
Sort of a breakdown, wasn't it?
It was yes.
Maybe we should...
Sunak the Breakdown. Okay, so this is the Two Mats, episode 25, Sunak the Breakdown.
Enjoy.
So, Matt, what are we going to talk about this week? Because there's very little stuff to talk about this week.
Not much going on. It's been a bit quiet this week. Yeah. I was struggling as I was on my way in.
What a day.
Episode 97,000 of the slow implosion of the Tory party. But it's funny because, you know, as I expect listeners think, you know, we during the days before we record this, we're recording this on Thursday, we tend to sort of WhatsApp each other. And you think, right, this is going to be the subject.
Yeah.
And this week... we've gone from Boris Johnson at the COVID inquiry to the Prime Minister calling an emergency press conference to snap at the press about his disastrous Rwanda policy.
I mean, in the last 24 hours.
Yeah, just that.
We have, as you say, Johnson at the COVID being interrogated, not very effectively, I thought, by Hugo Keith Casey, but we can talk about that. We then went... into, oh, Suella Braverman's making a big statement, sitting in Geoffrey Howe's seat in the House of Commons.
Big symbolism.
And that was a bit of an anticlimax. I think everybody thought everyone was going to jump. Then we have Robert Jenrick saying that this fascist bill isn't fascist enough for me, mate.
Yes.
And resigning. And then we have Rishi Sunak coming out and doing this podium thing, which struck me, and we tweeted it. I honestly thought it looked like a guy having a breakdown.
Well, and in between, we had Suella Braverman having a sort of round two on the Today programme.
With Sir Nick Robinson.
Should we have, if producer Ollie can play us that clip?
There's a team of lawyers in the Star Chamber, independent lawyers who are going to be scrutinising this. They will be providing some important conclusions very, very soon. I think we have to all read those conclusions carefully.
If there he doesn't change, should he remain leader of your party?
Listen... no one's talking about leadership or changing leadership.
Forgive me, that's nonsense, and you know it's nonsense. People are talking about changing the leadership. You know they are, and I suggest to you that you've had meetings to discuss it as well. So I'm going to ask you again, if he doesn't do what you demand, will you plot against him to remove him as leader of the Conservative Party?
I want the Prime Minister to succeed in stopping the boats.
So, you know, there you can see... you've got a former Home Secretary who actually got Sunak the job in October by backing him, refusing to say that he's going to be prime minister in the next election. So, unbelievably, around Westminster today, Thursday, there are MPs, Conservative MPs, talking about another leadership contest.
Hooray!
I don't think there will be one. But the fact that it's an issue, the fact you have Rishi Sunak at the 1922 Committee of Backbenchers on Wednesday evening saying unite or die, a phrase immortalised by Ian Duncan Smith, you know, another successful Tory leader. There's a kind of incremental collapse to this.
Yeah.
Actually, it's beyond incremental now, I think.
Well, I mean, Nick Robinson, big shout out to him.
Very good interview.
And a brilliantly delivered kind of monologue, it's been described, as where he basically goes through the litany of divisive politics that Suella Braverman has been perpetrating for the last however long, and then just says, you know, you're a headline grabber who works best in creating poison, don't you? And that's exactly her nail.
And she didn't really deny it. She's proud of the fact that she always says she's a plain speaker, which is, you know, the sort of the euphemism now. I mean, I find it amazing, having written about the Conservatives for a fair number of years now, that the big argument in the Conservative Party at the moment is between how illegal they want to be. You know, you've got the Prime Minister saying this bill will be pretty illegal as far as the ECHR, the European Convention on Human Rights, is concerned, to the extent that on the front of the bill, on the face of the bill, there has to be and is a disclaimer by James Cleverly, the Home Secretary, saying, I can't guarantee that this is consistent with international law.
Yeah.
But that's not enough. It's because it's not. It doesn't go far enough in renouncing our obligations to charters and international rules, international law, that you have Braverman, now a free-range kind of Exocet missile, and Robert Jenrick, who was twice Rishi Sunak's backer in leadership contests, resigning with a very long and damning letter.
And the challenge is actually more specific than just the umbrella of international law, isn't it? The actual challenge that they're dealing with, and which Sunak was wrestling with throughout that bizarre press conference, was the fact, and this is the fact which should make all British people feel slightly ashamed today, was the fact that they've got to make it good enough for Rwanda. Rwanda is the force that's saying,
it's amazing,
we need to abide by this law, otherwise we're not playing ball.
You have this incredible thing that's Sunak, on the one hand, there's a handful of One Nation Tories saying, we're actually not keen on this breaking international law stuff. And then, as you say, the Rwandan government saying, hang on a minute, you know, we've got our reputation to think of. You know, we can't.
It's already been soiled dealing with the United Kingdom, but we're not going to go that far.
We are in this relationship with the Rwanda. We are the people who are threatening the international rules-based order.
And we're going to talk later with Jason Pack, a
about
great guest,
just
about
that,
order.
About
you know?
All that. And the Conservative Party, which for so long was obsessed by the rule of law and order, has consigned that along with so much else. And I think there's so much going on here. I mean, one of the things is that you've seen Sunak, first of all, try and reinvent himself as the change candidate at the party conference, which was hilarious and ridiculous. Then there was the autumn statement, which was, here's some tax cuts and some bashing of welfare claimants. Will that do?
Yeah.
Didn't move the polls at all. And now they've become really a single issue campaign around migration and illegal immigration. The truth is that it's a terrible subject to choose if you're going to be a single issue party, because it's very, very complicated. And this pretense that all that they need to do is pass enough laws, forge enough treaties, shout enough at the judges, obviously it's sensitive, it's nuanced, it's complex. There needs to be a lot more resourcing into, you know, the dealing of cases and so on. I mean, that wouldn't do any harm. But what you are seeing here is the eternal problem of populist governments, which is trying to find simple solutions to complex problems, and surprise there aren't any.
Why has he bet the entire farm on this policy to export people to Rwanda?
I think, and I have thought for a long time, that he's a very bad politician.
Yeah.
And I think that although he is not an instinctive culture warrior, it can never be said often enough that during the first leadership contest of 2022, in July, he said his only disagreement with the Rwanda policy was it didn't go far enough.
Yeah.
And he clearly thought, right, I've got to, you know, my primary job will be to stabilize the economy, but I'm going to fight culture wars as on the side because I'm mindful of the Red Wall Coalition and all these rather sort of vague terms, actually. And I think he just made a decision that stop the boats was his, it used to be referred to as Plan B, you know, alongside the economy. And it's become more and more his fixation. And actually, it's a very poor basis for a re-election campaign because, you know, there is a whole spectrum of views on migration policy. But, you know, it's not the main issue at the moment. People are worried about cost of living. They're worried about putting food on the table, rent. They're worried about the cost of fuel. The boats are not what people are talking about.
And it's not even as... I mean, the boats won't stop completely just because of the Rwanda policy. So, I mean, it's worth kind of just reminding the supposed logic, the rationale behind the Rwanda thing is that it'll put the people in Calais off coming. Well, the people in Calais and the 122,000 people that are waiting to be currently processed by the Home Office, 122,000 people waiting to be processed, right? They, not all of them are going to say, oh, right, the hell with that. So that won't completely stop the boats. The number of people we'll be able to ship off to Rwanda, even if they make this thing work and the Rwandans say, well, okay, we'll take the
money. In the hundreds at the most.
A couple of hundred people.
Yes.
As someone said on Twitter, it's a rounding error. It's of no consequence whatsoever. And yet he has made this the totemic policy that he has made this the hill he is going to die on.
It's extraordinary.
And he will die on it.
I know. I mean, it's... In my view, this is it. I mean, I think it's been over for a long time, but these few days have represented just the movement when we've gone from moribund to dead.
I just can't think of anything in my lifetime of such small consequence, of such insignificance in the great scheme of things, even when you're putting it in the context of tackling something they've decided is the big issue of the time. I can't think of anything of that such small consequence that a prime minister has decided to make the thing that he is going to.
Well, it's a symbol, isn't it?
Yeah,
because
it
starts with Brexit, sovereignty, you know, our rights as a nation, border control, and then it moves to illegal immigration and people traffickers and the boats and the gangs and stopping that. And then it moves to this very complex business of flying people off to another country. And you choose Rwanda for that, which brings with it all sorts of obvious problems. And you say, right, that's the thing that, you know, judge me on.
Yeah.
And although it was very interesting that he will not make the sort of confidence vote.
Well, exactly. He's bottled that. Which is very telling, isn't it?
It is very telling. And I think that what you're seeing now is it's just a question of how long and how.
So listen, Matt, you're in Rishi Sunak's communications team. He isn't. I'm postulating here. He's had the day of days today. Everything's at rock bottom. What should he do now salvage something?
Okay, if I was advising him, and thank God I'm not, but I would say call an election. Yeah. Because his government is now morally bust. And if it drags on for another almost year, everything will be worse by then. The economy might be a bit better, but no thanks to anything that's being done by the government. And already you're seeing a kind of barely concealed leadership contest going on. So you've got Boris Johnson desperately trying at the COVID inquiry to salvage what's left of his reputation. You had Braverman posturing, making her campaign launch a couple of times. You had Kemi Badenoch making a very sort of a robust intervention in the House about gender policy yesterday.
And she, by the way, worth pausing, I think she, of all of those candidates, we exchanged WhatsApps, she's the one that looks the most adult in the room to me.
Well, she may be. I mean, I think that she's got a very good chance of winning, which is not inconsistent with what you just said.
Yeah.
But and then to finish the quartet, you had Robert Jenrick resigning. Yeah. And Jed Jenrick, extraordinarily and amazingly, because his nickname around Westminster is Generic because of his capacity to fancies himself as a leadership contender. I mean, you'll be amazed by...
Well, obviously, if Robert Jenrick is the answer to the to Britain, we should all pack up and emigrate.
No, absolutely. And I think that is there not, you know, to use that old Frank Kermode phrase, a sense of an ending about all this?
Yeah.
You know, that it's pathetic to watch the government of the sixth wealthiest nation on earth implode over something so bloody stupid. What's the prize?
The utter absence of any progress anywhere.
What is the great prize at the end of this that, all this hot air and tetchiness and fury and posturing and bogus culture wars, what's the great dividend going to be? And we all know that even if, let's say, just as a hypothetical, all of the things that he says are in the bill operate, even then, as you say, the numbers that they can send to Rwanda in the next year will be in the hundreds.
It's of no consequence.
It's all performative.
Yeah.
And I think that is the most worrying thing about it, because, for all the reasons that we discuss every week on the podcast, there are huge challenges facing this country.
Yeah.
The performative politics that has dominated politics since Brexit has got to stop. And this is sort of task number one for Labour, really, if they get in.
There was a great tweet, I thought, by Zoe Gardner, who's somebody I've admired for a long time, who's very, very strong on this immigration and asylum challenge. And she said, if you look at the one thing, they say they've exhausted everything. They've exhausted everything, and this is now, they're throwing the kitchen sink at it. But the one thing they haven't offered to do is provide a simple, safe route for people in Calais to come over and to process them quickly and humanely, and then to have an actual structure to what could happen to them beyond. They haven't even tried to do that.
And we all know that this is going to become more of an issue rather than less. Climate change alone is going to make population mobility more of a story in the coming decades. So we need systems that work, not just kind of... a supposed deterrence. And it's interesting, if you talk to people who know about deterrence psychology, the thing about deterrence is unless they are they visibly work, they make the system worse.
Right.
So the idea that people in Calais, who have gone through hell probably to get there, hear that they're going to be sent to Rwanda, and hear on the grapevine that no one has been sent to Rwanda, it will actually make them more enthusiastic to have a go to get over, because they'll think this is a joke government.
Of course.
And they'd be right.
Of course. And they are right. Of course they are. It is utterly, utterly depressing. But there we go. Let's take a quick break there. And when we come back, we're going to talk to the super Jason Pack, who is
a wise man,
expert on the Middle East, has got some really, really great things to say about how that problem may play out and may actually improve one of these days, which
as they say, as Nathan Darby would say, wise opinions
coming in part two, folks. Stay tuned. Thank you for listening to the Two Mats, and if you like the kind of conversations we have here, there are loads more to be had in print and online at The New European, and I have got a very special offer for all listeners of the Two Mats. We are giving away copies of Alistair Campbell's Diaries 2023, which is a book we're publishing this month. It's a fantastic diary full of everything that's happened, all the people he's met, and anybody who's a fan of Alistair Campbell's diaries over the years know how brilliantly he turns them out. He is very much a latter-day Samuel Pepys.
He really is.
He is. So you can get a free copy of Alistair Campbell's Diaries 2023, worth £20 when you subscribe to The New European from as little as £1 a week. Or if you like getting the newspaper delivered to your door every single week, you can have that for just another pound a week. And that's a 75% saving on the price you'll pay at the newsagents. To get this great offer, go to www.theneweuropean.co.uk/2mats. That's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S. Tell them I sent you, and you'll get your free copy of Alistair Campbell's Diary 2023 delivered to you in time for Christmas.
Tell them Matt sent you. I like it.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
So welcome back, folks. And I'm delighted to say we are joined by Jason Pack, the host of the Disorder podcast, the fabulous Disorder podcast.
Excellent podcast.
We have been listening to it regularly. It's very, very impressive. And we will talk about that some more. And Jason, we can talk about a million things, but you're an expert on Middle East, on Libya, on the kind of the fragmentation of nationhood and how people are constantly now being reduced to internecine battles within themselves without making much progress in the world. Matt, I know you're...
Well, I was just, following that, really. Yeah. It's great to have you, Jason. And I was fascinated by the article. And I wondered if you could talk to our listeners a bit about how Qatar is the pathway, offers a potential pathway to peace.
Well, thank you for the kind framing. When I look at the discourse, both in the U.S. and here in England, I see a focus on the hyper-short term. How do we get the hostages back? How do we get more aid in? Can we have a ceasefire or not? And then the hyper-long term. Oh, what does a two-state solution look like? What is one state? And unfortunately, the reality is we can't jump from the hyper-short term to the hyper-long term. And no one is discussing the middle term. So my proposal, Matt and Matt, is that we need to have a regional coalition, call it a pan-Arab condominium, that would step in to administer Gaza the day after. And it seems very clear to me that the Netanyahu government has no plan for this war. They don't even know how to eliminate Hamas, which is their stated aim. And they certainly don't know what the metric of are they winning or losing the war. Part of the reason is that they have no end goal that they're going for. Oh, it's going to be an indefinite Israeli occupation. And then the American solution, oh, well, the PA is going to be resurrected and Abu Mazen will somehow be legitimate and he's going to govern Gaza. Those things don't make any sense. So you can't get out of this war unless there is someone who's going to be governing Gaza the day after.
And?
The swing state here is Qatar, because I visualize world politics in the post-2011 era as a struggle between orderers and disorderers, and not crucially between autocrats and democrats. The Qataris are a swing power here. They work sometimes with disorderers like Iran and Hamas, but they're also rooted in the global order, and they're the ones arranging the hostage swaps. And if they really want to, you know, make sure that Hamas has no safe haven and can't get funds, and that Gazans can have fresh, brand new schools and scholarships to study in Europe and all that, it's the Qataris who can be the swing player. And why don't we actually use this as a moment to get all of the other regional actors who are traditionally anti-Qatar, like Egypt, the UAE, and Saudi, working with the Qataris against Iran. In other words, to isolate the disorderers and avoid exactly the fragmentation on the regional level, which we've seen you know, playing out in so many spheres.
It's fascinating because I remember when the first podcast we did after October the 7th, one of the things we discussed was who runs Gaza after, whenever after is, and however one defines after. And I think we kind of came up with UN or a kind of Bosnia kind of protectorate. But actually, that sounds a better and more plausible. I'm very interested in who and how it might come about. But another question related to that I wanted to ask was, Putin going to the UAE is, you know, was quite a bold move. And where you think Putin stands now in relation to the region, because obviously Russia's traditionally, at least in recent decades, been at least affected a kind of neutrality. But now it seems to be aligning itself more with the global south. And what do you think Putin's strategy is there?
You're right in saying that Russia has traditionally been able to work with both Israel and the Arabs. I wouldn't say that there's a neutrality. The Russians have been internal powers in the Middle East since 2011. They are in Syria. They essentially run Syria. So they're in this axis of disorderers. And one of the things that they've been able to do since 2011, particularly aided by the Trump term in America, is to work with the hardline anti-Muslim Brotherhood grouping. And this is the UAE and Sisi's Egypt against Morsi, and the Saudis. And so, for example, they provide arms to the same countries that the U.S. provides arms to. It's quite bizarre looked at from a Clinton-era kind of perspective. And so that Trump worked with the Russians in Europe also allowed him to work with the UAE and Saudi and the Russians in the Middle East. He was fully bought into the Russian regional vision of a axis of strongman anti-Muslim Brotherhood autocrats, and that's what allowed the blockade against Qatar from 2017 to January 2021, which was supported by Kushner and his ties with the Emiratis. Biden has tried to rebalance, but he hasn't presented an alternate vision because we still have this domestic fissure within the West between those who support the Emiratis and those who support the Qataris. And I think that that has, one, led to the rise of neo-populism in Israel, where Netanyahu and his right-wing, you know, nutcase settlers are in control and work with the Emiratis. But also an inability to get our regional allies all on the same page. A feature of the global enduring disorder, which I unpack in my disorder program, is that our allies, meaning the West's allies, are themselves bifurcated. In other words, we're allies with Turkey, but Turkey fights against Egypt. We're allies with Qatar. We have our El Udeid air base there, and we're allies with the Emirates, but then they are fighting each other. If we let this persist, these outrages are going to continue, and you're going to see things similarly to this. So we need to use this as a moment, and I see the Qataris as that swing player.
Explain to me the background between the disjunction between the Qataris and the Emiratis.
Sure. Very difficult to do in a short format, but briefly put, obviously, Britain had a series of treaties in the 19th century with these different sheikhs. The Truckle states, which became the UAE, went on one trajectory, and they have a non-Wahhabi Islam. The Qataris have the same kind of Wahhabism, which comes from Saudi Arabia, and they didn't hit oil early. They discovered their gas much later. They're right. Like the insurgent power. Their foreign ministry is less developed. They don't have a Dubai-like commercial spirit. Their Islam is a little bit more conservative. Right. And they've been this insurgent power. And under the emir's father, so the current emir's father who ruled until 2013, he conducted a lot of his regional politics through the Muslim Brotherhood.
Right.
And he thought that Sunni Islamism was a way to undermine the Emiratis and the Saudis. And it's relevant that the Saudis have tried, for example, to overthrow different emirs in Qatar. So there's like a complicated relationship here. And during the blockade, the Saudis actually tried to turn Qatar into an island, like to literally cut it off and make a moat around it so that it was stuck in the Persian Gulf. So there's these different internecine feuds that as Britain left the Gulf, you know, with Harold Macmillan's East of Suez speech, you've had this feud going on and on and on and on and on. And unfortunately, Trump chose one side. He chose the Emirati side, having to do with Jared Kushner, who took billions of dollars from the Emiratis for 666 Fifth Avenue. Again, really, really long story short, Biden should be rebalancing here to get these guys all on the same page against Iran, but he hasn't really done that. And this is the moment, because the Qataris have proved to us only they can deliver the hostages. And it's important to back up. Egypt is traditionally the mediator between Hamas and the Israelis. Egypt is the one with the deep intelligence services. Egypt is a country that has 90 million people. It's not like Qatar, there's less than 400,000 Qataris. But the Egyptians, they don't want to govern Gaza. They want to wash their hands of the whole thing. They're really threatened by the Muslim Brotherhood. They're not a swing player anymore. They rely on the Saudis and Emiratis for fundings. The Qataris have the money and the inclination to cut a regional image. You know, the way that they buy football clubs in this country or
sponsor, you know, a World Cup. Yeah, host a World Cup.
Whatever.
Yeah.
I need to say to them, hey, you want to pretend that you're a medium power? Well, great. Put on your big boy pants, step up to the global table, and do something to be orderers.
Right.
Speaking of the big table, we're recording this on Thursday, and last night, Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General, invoked Article 99 of the Charter, i.e. telling the Security Council this is a serious crisis, which is, I think, very rarely invoked. How do you rate the UN's performance in this, if at all, Jason? I mean, I'm genuinely interested because the UN has to work, doesn't it? It needs to work in some way.
What is the meaning of the word has, Matt? Article 99 hasn't been invoked since the 1980s.
Right.
I propose regional solutions because the UN is completely moribund to my mind. Keep in mind that the Russians can just veto whatever is or is not proposed. We need to propose something alternative to what the UN does. I think that Guterres has no cut through either leverage over Israel or America, nor moral standing with the Global South and the regional players. It's a complete joke. He may be well-intentioned, and obviously we're seeing a humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza. And the key thing is that he's going to the short-termism, oh, we should have a ceasefire. Great. What do you propose when there is the ceasefire and the Israelis withdraw and Hamas is neither defeated and there are no governance things in place? It's classical enduring disorder, do you know what I mean? That one side is bickering with the other and yet they propose nothing.
I mean, it's this sort of slightly worrying landscape, and now we really are stepping back, of disaggregation. You know, obviously, on the podcast, we talk a lot about Britain's no longer membership of the EU. We're talking about the UN really not stepping up to the plate. We have the prospect of a second Trump term, which would be a mortal danger to NATO. I mean, is the subtext, or perhaps the text of what you're saying, Jason, that actually we've got to rely less on these massive supranational organizations and think more regionally?
I'd like supranational organizations to work. I'm a big believer in NATO and the EU. Mm. They don't have a role in governing Gaza. It is interesting that Ehud Olmert wrote an article in Haaretz, and he's the former Israeli prime minister, from a kind of centrist Likud perspective. And he said, well, what if we had NATO peacekeepers? And knowing that the UN is totally can't function. I mean, look at how the UN has, quote unquote, administered Libya or tried to bring about elections in Libya. So he knows that the UN can't work. So he said, well, what about NATO? The problem is that why would some white Christian NATO be welcomed in Gaza? They won't be. They're seen as an appendage to Israeli power, you know, and the Americans have managed to botch this, because although they are behind closed doors pushing Netanyahu, like, please bomb less, please do other things, publicly they haven't differentiated themselves sufficiently from the Israelis in the eyes of the region. So I think we need a regional solution. But I believe in international institutions. I mean, I have a joke here. I never met a domain that I don't want an international regulation for. And that's my kind of, you know, big state international liberalism. My problems are with how the regulations are implemented or how the institutions play out, but I want to regulate climate change and governance of Gaza and tax havens and all of it with very, very supranational solutions.
You invoked a Bedouin saying, which you said it was a famous Bedouin saying. I'd never heard it before, but I thought it was absolutely wonderful and apposite for, I mean, not just what's going on in the Middle East, but you could see layers of it everywhere. And the saying is that it's me against my brother and I against my cousin, and my brother, my cousin and I against the outsider. And so it's a way of describing layers of almost institutionalized paranoia and self-interest against actually a longer term self-interest where the truth is we all make progress if we can all work in a greater state of harmony. We seem to have gone massively backwards in quite a short period of time.
Correct.
Why?
Oh my, I wish I knew. But I would say that when I first lived in the Middle East, I lived in Syria in 2003, I saw that playing out between different communities, between Alawites and Druze and this town and that town. But I never thought it would be us in the West. And now this proverb applies to us. You can't get the British and Americans to have shared foreign policy towards Libya. You need something as catastrophic as Ukraine to get the Americans and the Brits, in theory, the two closest allies, to be on the same page. We can't agree on the same carbon targets.
Yeah.
You can't get even Sweden and Denmark, you know, when the Svenska Demokraterna are in, to agree on the similar relationship to the EU. So we've become like the brother and the cousin Bedouins fighting and squabbling amongst ourselves, which shows you the absurdity of Brexit, which is that Britain has 98% the same interests as its continental partners. Yes. So why have we gotten here? I postulate that we're in this thing called the enduring disorder. The enduring disorder has multiple causations. One is the withdrawal of American hegemony, that America has relatively less power. And since the failure catastrophically of the Iraq War, we have less of a desire for global leadership. And this wasn't caused by Trump. It predates Trump. Obama himself wanted to do less global leadership, and probably with good reason, right? So there's the long-term withdrawal of American hegemony. But unfortunately, it has been withdrawn simultaneously with American convening power. Because I think it'd be great if we're less of global hegemon. That's great. You know, the Europeans should do more and we can work with our other allies. But we should still have a convening power. The problem is we've withdrawn some of that convening power. So that's one point. Then, you know, just cyber and misinformation and the atomized media landscape. And, you know, you can't make a living as a journalist anymore. And there's no neutral facts. Where are the neutral facts? It used to be, you know, Dan Rather told you the facts or the BBC. And then a right-meaning Tory and a centrist-meaning Labour guy, they debated how to solve it, but they didn't disagree about the fact.
Right.
Now our debates are like, Obama's a Kenyan.
Right.
Or is he a Kenyan? Yeah. Is he American? There's no neutral facts. I mean, if you watch Al Jazeera and you hear about the genocide in Palestine, and then you listen to, for example, CNN about, you know, what the humanitarian things that were suffered on October 7th, they are just not even having similar conversations.
No, so politics is in a quantum state of multiple realities. It's just very, very troubling. That, as you say, you can't have a debate about around an agreed set of facts at all anymore. It's enough of a job to keep the facts there. And, you know, fact-checking is a growing industry, but it shouldn't have to be.
Mm. Correct. And the interesting thing about my proposals to connect the Qatari-led pan-Arab condominium for post-war Gaza to this issue of neutral facts, I have a colleague, Jonathan Schanzer, at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in the U.S. He's an important former Treasury Department official. He works with Trumpian and anti-Trumpian Republicans. I've always considered him too pro-UAE. I wrote my piece, I proposed it, and he's like, you can't be serious, you're in bed with the Qatari lobby. And then I see he's written in the New York Post, we should be sanctioning the Qataris and blaming them for the attack and not working with them to get the hostages.
So he's taken a side, and you're on the other side.
The interesting thing here is we both want to get the hostages, we both want to have, you know, Israel living at peace with the Palestinian state.
Yeah.
But the state of things is that despite the fact that he knows Arabic and Hebrew, and I know Arabic and Hebrew, we're in this partisan thing that he's a Republican and I'm a Democrat, and therefore my solution is too pro-Qatari and his is too pro-Emirati, and we can't even discuss it.
So instant dialectic.
You put it into, you put it brilliantly. You said we're now living post 2016 in the tribalization of politics. And you define that as an inability of factions to put aside feuds to focus on shared interests.
Correct.
And this was the key sentence, until forced to by existential threats. And that's where we are now seeing, I think, some existential threats bubbling up in the Middle East, in Ukraine, the climate, all sorts of things that are real fundamental challenges that you have to focus on. It's obviously going to get worse before it gets better. But will it get? Is there a kind of better place that we'll get to on the other side sooner than later, do you think?
I have no crystal ball, probably less ability to see into one than you guys with a little bit greater experience. But I'm afraid it's going to have to get a lot worse until it clarifies minds. So we have an identitarian politics about this Israel-Palestine thing. If you're a Christian Zionist or even a secular Jew, you're going to respond to some people's pain and suffering in one way. If you're on the global left and the underprivileged and whatever, you're responding in one way. Look at the two opposing demonstrations. Our interest is in tamping this down so that the disorderers, Russia and Iran, don't win. But they've already won. Militarily, Hamas has already won. It was over before the Israelis even overreacted, because one, it was so obvious that with Netanyahu in power, they would overreact. But what we in the West should, in theory, have as an interest is making sure that this war doesn't continue, that there are off-ramps. But we're not doing that.
And it's or escalate.
Not, oh, yeah. I mean, it may easily escalate. Yeah. But I think that that's just one microcosm. We're not winning in Ukraine. And that's very, very sad. That hurts me even more, because we could have probably won if we had just gotten Zelensky the weapons sooner. Like, yeah. You know, not for this summer offensive, but for the previous yes. summer offensive.
Yeah.
And it's like, you're kidding me. They just didn't give it to them on time. And that's why we're not going to win?
Yeah.
And now Congress is withholding funds in the States for Ukraine. So, you know, that trend is heading downwards.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to get worse. I mean, we don't want to devolve into a full out discussion about 2024, because somehow whenever you discuss this, it gets to, well, what's going to happen in 2024? I think that people are so selfish, whether it's their... I was offended. I need a safe space. We can't talk about it this way, to make the difficult choices. I thought you guys were a little unfair on Kissinger in last week's pod. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he probably was a war criminal. I agree with that. But he made hard decisions and he got the Israelis to compromise. He's actually the only international statesman who did a successful shuttle diplomacy that culminated in a lasting peace agreement.
Oh, we did say that, I think.
We did.
But you were really hard on him, I would argue. Yeah. And you kind of poo-pooed realpolitik, because it is about making people make hard choices.
Yeah.
And Blinken seems like a nice enough guy, but I don't think that he's really ready to make people make hard choices.
No, I agree with that. I think that's
Where are you on the a second Trump term is inevitable?
Oh, no. I think he's an underdog.
Yeah. You still think he's an underdog?
Oh, yeah. He's got 30 to 40%. I would prefer if it wasn't Biden who was opposing him.
Right.
And if it was Biden opposing him, I would really prefer if it wasn't a Kamala VP choice. Like, if he just took Buttigieg to go on our Maltese dynamics here, I think he'd be in a great position. Run with the Maltese stallion in the number two position. Yeah. And then you're going to show a little bit of youth and a little bit of dynamism, right?
Yeah.
However, he was a dog against Clinton. A few things had to fall, from not just the Russian influence, but the way in which the email gate exactly played out, the way in which the Access Hollywood tape was just far enough away from the election. I think that you really need to think about these things like sports. Frequently, an underdog wins. You know, the shot from the favorite hits the post. It doesn't score.
Yeah.
And then, what do you know, there was a free kick in the corner and it hit someone's elbow, and I mean. So I'm not comfortable in a situation where Trump is a 30 to 40% to win the election, because the existential nature of what that can do to the planet that I care a lot about, I'm not comfortable with that. Yeah. He needs to be below 10%. So we need to be more bringing our A game. And the problem is that although Biden is handling behind closed doors both Ukraine and Israel-Palestine very, very well, he has extremely little levers, because he doesn't control Congress. He can't really get the funding to the Ukrainians. It wasn't really his fault that more arms were not given to the Ukrainians earlier. And Netanyahu is a psychopath who hates Biden. So if Biden had come out more and been like, hey, you can't be doing this bombing campaign, Netanyahu would have gone behind his back, used particularly Republican Jews against him. Mm. He's completely pinned in.
Yeah.
And I think that he means well, but that might not be enough.
Yeah.
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 Well, it probably won't.
I don't think it will. Well, listen,
we
all mean well, and thank you for coming in. I hope that shed some light on a massively complex situation, which
really
won't
has,
be solved
yeah.
anytime soon. And And will you come back, please?
Please come back and help us. God, you have 2024.
You have a lot of nice Korean and Japanese restaurants just around here. So if you record around lunchtime, I think you
perfect.
Could lure.
Right, okay, you could that's lure the way to lure you.
All right,
and
okay.
I'd love to have you guys both on the Disorder Pod because what we can draw out is how Britain post Brexit is a microcosm for exactly the global enduring disorder. You know, how the mighty have fallen.
Regrettably so, yes.
You see all of the things from tax havens to reversals on climate change to inabilities. And one of the things I admired Britain in its glory days is the ability for Labour, Liberal, Lib Dems, and the Tories to work together on certain kinds of foreign policy issues. That's completely gone.
Yeah.
So I think having you guys on will be a great way to connect our listenerships.
Fantastic. Super. We will definitely do that. So tune into the Disorder Podcast in the same places you find the two mats, which is everywhere you find your podcast.
Absolutely, yeah.
Thank you, Jason, for coming on. And we'll see you again.
See you soon.
Next time.
Thank you, mate.
Ciao, ciao.
Thanks.
So thanks again to Jason. Matt, what didn't we have time to talk about this week?
Well, we said goodbye to Benjamin Zephaniah.
We did.
Age 65, which is very sad. I remember buying the Dread Affair, which I think is second collection in the mid-80s. And just he was such an incredibly important cultural presence. And it's quite shocking, isn't it? He'd been diagnosed
8 weeks
only
ago.
8 weeks ago.
With a brain tumour.
And he's only 65. So it's a really sad.
Can I do something unusual and maybe test people's patience? But can I read a Benjamin Zephaniah poem?
I would love that.
Because I think it's the most apposite poem that could possibly be today. And
go
it's called The British. Take some picked Celts and Scyllias and let them settle, then overrun them with Roman conquerors. Remove the Romans after approximately 400 years, add lots of Norman French to some Angles, Saxons, Jutes and Vikings, then stir vigorously. Mix some hot Chileans, cool Jamaicans, Dominicans, Trinidadians, Bajans, with some Ethiopians, Chinese, Vietnamese and Sudanese. Then take a blend of Somalians, Sri Lankans, Nigerians and Pakistanis. Combine them with some Guyanese and turn up the heat. Sprinkle some fresh Indians, Malaysians, Bosnians, Iraqis and Bangladeshis together with some Afghans, Spanish, Turkish, Kurdish, Japanese and Palestinians. Then add to the melting pot. Leave the ingredients to simmer. As they mix and blend, allow their languages to flourish, binding them together with English. Allow time to cool. Add some unity, understanding and respect for the future. Serve with justice and enjoy. Note: all the ingredients are equally important. Treating one ingredient better than another will leave a bitter, unpleasant taste. Warning: an unequal spread of justice will damage the people and cause pain. Give justice and equality to all.
Fantastic.
Rest in peace, Benjamin Zephaniah.
Rest in peace.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. As ever, get your questions in and any feedback to the two mats at tnepublishing.com. That's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S. At tnepublishing.com. Or if you listen on Spotify, you can message us there. That's exactly what Danny did, who says, should there be a Brexit inquiry? Well, we might answer that question in our Q&A on Sunday. And don't forget our special Christmas deal where you can get a copy of Alistair Campbell's fantastic Diaries 2023 by subscribing to The New European from as little as £1 a week. And in doing so, you will be supporting our independent journalism against the right-wing nationalism that is causing all of this trouble these days. Head to thenew.co.uk/2mats. That's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S. And there is a link in the show notes. Thanks to our producer, Ollie Peart at Rethink Audio, assisted by Matt Hill. And until next week,
it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
Goodbye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.